According to Beverage Industry Magazine, sales of sports drinks in the United States now exceed a staggering $3 billion annually. Internationally recognized human performance expert Tim Noakes credits much of the rise in the popularity of these drinks to the industry's modern marketing tactics and the strength of a unique positive product image. Unfortunately, these tactics have also led athletes and fitness enthusiasts to falsely believe that they're unable to naturally monitor their hydration levels and drink accordingly. In his forthcoming book, Waterlogged, The Serious Problem of Overhydration in Endurance Sports, available from Human Kinetics in May 2012, Noakes debunks beliefs about hydration that have taken hold over the past 30 years. He shows how the past three decades have been not only a time of runaway success for the sports drink industry, but also a time in which an epidemic of exercise-associated hyponatremia, a potentially fatal condition caused by overdrinking during extended exercise, has struck endurance athletes worldwide. As Noakes' research shows, sports drink industry marketing methods have helped sustain the idea that dehydration is a medical condition with a specific set of symptoms, such as confusion, dizziness, nausea, cramping, and fainting, that can be diagnosed and prevented, such as by ingesting more sports drinks during exercise. But Noakes says the treatments are more likely to cause or exacerbate the underlying condition. Noakes, who is also a medical doctor and an exercise physiologist, stresses that the only symptom of dehydration is thirst. Dehydration is not a medical condition or disease that produces a variety of unique symptoms. So if an otherwise healthy athlete seeking medical care is not thirsty, it's unlikely that dehydration is the cause of any illness or symptoms that may be present at the same time. I spoke to Dr. Tim Noakes from his office in the University of Cape Town in South Africa. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for wanting to speak to me.
Well, your work is just so interesting, and certainly you've been such a major figure in this world, so it's very exciting for me to have the chance to talk to you about your work.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
So I'm quite interested in this new book that you've got, but I just wanted to actually start by getting some context on it. I'm curious about how you came to write this book in the context of your previous work.
Okay, well, on June the 1st, 1981, when it all started. And about a month later, I received a letter from a lady who'd run the Comrades Marathon on June the 1st, 1981. And she'd lost consciousness shortly after the race. And she wanted to know what had happened. She'd been hospitalized she'd been unconscious for 4 days. She'd been in hospital for 6 days. And she wanted to know what had happened. And she was diagnosed with a low blood sodium concentration. And that I knew had never been described in a runner before in the history of running. And I was challenged to find out what had caused the problem. So I originally said I thought she'd lost too much sodium because she had diarrhea. I thought maybe that was the cause. And the thought that she might have drunk too much was completely, we would never have thought that, because we were so conditioned to believe that dehydration causes everything in running, so that how could anyone ever drink too much? So I then went and listened to the stories of three other athletes I managed to find with the same condition. And then in 1985, we published our first paper. And from the history of what they had done and from simple calculations, I worked out that they must have drunk too much, that had to be the cause, that they'd become waterlogged. And we published that paper, and it happened at exactly the time that Gatorade had been bought. The company had been bought by, it wasn't Stokely Van Camp. I forget who bought Gatorade then. It'll come back to me. And they decided they were going to commercialize Gatorade and make profit from it. And they were going to do that by making sure runners drank lots during exercise. So it came along at just the wrong moment when runners were about to be told that they had to drink a lot during exercise. The next thing that happened was 1987. The evening of the next Comrades Marathon would have been May the 31st, 1987. At midnight, I got this distress call from a doctor working at the medical hospital near the finish of that year's Comrades Marathon. And she said, "Dr. Noakes, I've got 18 patients here. They've all got, they've all got low blood sodium concentrations. What must I do? And I said, well, they've overdrunk. For goodness sake, just don't give them fluids. Give them a diuretic to get rid of the fluids, and they should be fine. And then I realized that we were on the brink of a real problem, because in 1981 there had been one case. Now suddenly there were 18 serious hospitalized cases. So the next year I sent one of my students up to, and I told him he must hospitalize all the patients who've got the condition. And that year there were 8 patients, and he hospitalized them and studied them in detail and was able to show with absolute certainty that they'd all overdrunk during the race. And we published that paper in 1991, and we assumed that everyone would now accept that it's overdrinking that causes the problem. But it came exactly at the time, as I've indicated, that the sports drink industry was spreading its wings, so to speak. It was encouraging scientists to say that athletes weren't drinking enough. It was encouraging a new theory that dehydration was a really serious medical condition during exercise, and if you got dehydrated, you were going to die as a consequence. And so that was how it all started. And so it took me in conflict with my colleagues, because I didn't believe that, because I knew it wasn't true, because we had the evidence, the opposite evidence. And then during the mid-1990s, I got involved with a New Zealand physician, Dr. Dale Speedy, and he repeated some of the studies we'd done and came to exactly the same conclusions. And then I started writing a lot of papers and taking on the industry. And the more we said it's due to fluid overloads, the more the industry said, actually, you must drink as much as you possibly can during exercise. And provided you're drinking a sports drink, you'll be protected from the condition. So the book is really a history of how this happened and a look at the real science behind fluids during exercise.
Wow, that's a fascinating history, really. And one of the things that really emerges for me in your description of this is this challenge of knowledge production in scientific fields, that you came up with something that was extremely well supported, that was based on both observational and empirical evidence. And yet, you know, because of the time during which it emerged, it was really not taken up in a broader sense. And in fact, the response was almost a real pushback against what you were saying. So I find that quite interesting.
Well, I think that's the nature of science, that knowledge advances with glacial speed.
Yes, definitely true. So,
and anytime there's an earthquake, people don't like it. And but the other problem was that there was such commercial involvement, because right. The industry had clearly decided how they were going to market the product, and it meant telling people they must drink a lot. And if there was a scientist in South Africa saying the opposite, then he had to be demonized, and that's what happened.
Now, did you find that there was really there was really quite a systematic response to your work that was intended to either discredit it or simply set it aside?
Yeah, absolutely. There was every effort was made to make sure that we didn't publish our work in the top scientific journals. And that, again, was in part, I think, orchestrated by industry, because they made sure that this like-minded people were on the editorial boards of these journals. And so that when you sent a publication that related to fluids and exercise, it was always sent to the same group of scientists who had an opposite opinion. And we could tell, because we always got the same reviews. And they were always antagonistic, and they always said, we don't know what we're talking about. And that seemed strange, because we were just reporting what we'd found. So yes, it was orchestrated, and it was done very cleverly, in my opinion.
And I think that might be a little bit, for those of us who have come from academia, maybe not so surprising, but I think for folks who are not in the academic setting, who are not, who don't understand how journals work and so forth, this might come as a bit of a surprise, because I think that we typically assume, if we're outside of the academy, that knowledge is this very objective thing, that science is a very objective thing, and if facts are meant to be known, then we will know them regardless. So what I'm hearing you saying is actually that this is certainly not the case. And I think particularly in the field that you're working in, which is quite uniquely positioned at the nexus of, you know, scientific inquiry and the industry of sport and the industry of fitness. So could you comment a little bit more on the sports drink industry, you know, its emergence. I mean, you alluded to a bit of the history of it, but when did the sports drink industry really emerge as a phenomenon, and how has it developed over the years?
Well, if you look back when I started running in 1969 in South Africa, we were told not to drink during exercise. So Gatorade, in fact, was first formed in 1965. And by 1969, it was the most popular sort of drink in the United States and was very popular amongst football players. And that's who they targeted originally. So it was considered the drink that would prevent heat stroke and would allow your team to become very not fatigued in the fourth quarter of a football game. So your team would come back in the fourth quarter and win the games if they drank Gatorade. What happened next was 1976, running really became very popular with the New York City Marathon of that year. Up to that point, there were many marathons around the world, but if they had 100 runners, that was a lot. And the New York City Marathon just stimulated this interest in big city marathons. And all of a sudden, you got a new population of people exercising. And thereafter, the gyms came. Gyms really weren't around in the 1970s. So there was a whole new population of exercisers. And industry decided that they wanted everyone who exercised to drink. And that's how they did it, so that they targeted the new growth of people starting to exercise after the 1970s. And so if you look at Gatorade particularly, you'll see that its growth really starts about 1984, 1985. That's when it really starts to take off from, let's say, $100 million a year industry to, by the 1990s, $2 billion a year industry. So it goes from, it goes up major substantially, becomes a major player in the United States between 1982 and a decade later. So that was the growth period of the industry, was between 82 and 92.
Now, this is really interesting because what the sports drink industry has to overcome is this concept that if we're thirsty, we'll drink, right? And that our body would know when to drink. You know, how did they manage to override that fairly logical observation?
They coined the term, when you're thirsty, it's already too late, you're already dehydrated. And that became a mantra. And what they did in the United States is they connected to 62 scientists globally, a large number in the United States, but they choose the opinion makers, of course. And they then made sure that those people all sung out of the same hymn book. And that hymn book was that if you're dehydrated, if you're thirsty, you're already dehydrated and it's too late to start. And that just became the theme. But they had many other themes. And they developed what's called the science of hydration, which is a non-science. And that was the one thing, was that you must drink ahead of thirst, which, of course, as you've indicated, was completely contrary to everything that we know about mammalian physiology, or in fact, all creature physiology, because we don't have to tell any other creature to drink. They will drink when they're thirsty. So what makes humans unique of all the creatures on Earth that they have to be told when to drink? The next thing they say, the next theme was that you must always drink more rather than less. And the third theme was that you must drink an electrolyte glucose-containing sports drink rather than water. And that became the theme. And they drove that hydration science through the scientists and through the Gatorade Sports Science Institute. That was the themes that they sold, and in their advertising as well. So if you wanted to do research, your research had to prove one of those three or all three of those so-called facts. And then the studies were designed that they would always come up with that answer. And so that was the way they were able to sustain the mythology and build on it.
And actually, that was going to be my next question, which is, how did they convince the scientists to show this in their findings? How were the studies designed to show that drinking Gatorade was optional or optimal?
Well, the very famous study was 1992, and this was probably the key study. And two scientists at the University of Texas took a group of eight very good cyclists. They weren't ordinary cyclists, they were superior cyclists. And they had them cycle for 2 hours in a hot chamber at 35 degrees centigrade with relatively high humidity and no cooling, proper cooling with fans. So what they had was environmental conditions that would maximize sweating, and they chose athletes who would be able to sweat at high rates and sustain the exercise. And then they fed them either nothing or fluid at different rates, particularly at a very high rate. And they found that the more the guys drank, the lower is their body temperature. But even when they drank nothing, they finished the bout of exercise without any problems and without very high temperatures. So what they did was they then used a surrogate measure of risk of ill health and performance, the body temperature. And they said, you see, this surrogate measure is highest when you don't drink. Therefore, to lower this surrogate measure, you must drink. And you mustn't just drink a little, you must drink a lot. And they came up with an intake of 1.2 liters per hour, which is fine if you're an elite athlete exercising at 35 degrees centigrade with no convective cooling for 2 hours. In fact, cyclists probably wouldn't drink that amount anyway. But they generalized that, and these were big males, they were 70 kilogram males. They generalized that to any exercise anywhere in the world. And the tragedy was that women runners of 50 kilograms running, for example, the Boston Marathon in 6 hours, where they're barely running, they're only walking and running, in conditions of 10 degrees centigrade, were also drinking 1.2 liters per hour. And no one ever told them, hold on, if you're a small woman and it's cold, you don't need to drink that much. Had they done the experiment differently and say, let's say that I'll take a 4.5 hour marathon runner, we'll take moderate environmental conditions of 15 degrees centigrade, we'll do proper convective cooling, they would have found that those women only need to drink 400 ml per hour. Then they would have come up with guidelines which said all you need to do is drink 400 ml per hour. And that would have been totally different. And then the problem would never have arisen. So my conclusion is that experiment was designed to produce the highest possible sweat rates, which would then require the highest possible drinking rates to prevent so-called dehydration. And then you generalize that to the entire population and you have maximum sales of your product.
Now, it's interesting that you mentioned the differences in body size, the difference in sex. You know, many of the readers of my website are female. I'd be curious to know your thoughts on how sex differences affect the need for hydration or the need for fluid intake.
Well, they have a major impact because women are generally 10 to 15 kilograms lighter than men. If you look at certainly marathon runners in this country, that's what you would find. And they also generally run slower. So therefore, their energy expenditure is much lower. And the rate at which you're generating heat is dependent on your energy expenditure. So therefore, your rate of heat production is less. Therefore, your sweat rate will be less. And so a woman running a marathon in 4.5 hours, her maximum sweat rate would be 500 milliliters per hour, which is about 18 fluid ounces per hour. I would guess it's about 18 or 19 fluid ounces. But yet they were getting told to drink 40 fluid ounces, 1.2 liters per hour. And that, even that, is only appropriate for the race winners in these marathons. They're just not appropriate for slower runners. So again, to make the point, how fast you run and how big you are determines how much fluid you need to drink during exercise. The smaller you are and the slower you run, the less you need to drink. And since women are generally smaller and tend to run a bit slower than men, they'll need much less. What we've noticed, though, is women tend to drink more. For some reason, they tend to be more likely to drink more than men. And it may be because they follow instructions better. or they're more fastidious. But it's very clear that this condition of hyponatremia is much more prevalent amongst women. And we think it's because they're running slower and obviously they're drinking too much. And it's maybe because they're following the guidelines rather more effectively than the men do.
Well, I also wonder, too, about the role that drinking water is supposed to have in fat loss. I think in the back of many female athletes' minds is this concept of, you know, having to stay as lean as possible and having to always fight these biological forces that are conspiring to make us retain fat, you know. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's simply a dimension of it, perhaps not the whole picture, but perhaps one explanatory dimension. And I was actually going to ask if you see this hyponatremia more in women, and it seems like you do. So perhaps for the folks who don't know what hyponatremia involves, can you talk briefly about what it involves and what the symptoms are?
Absolutely. So let's take a woman runner running the Boston Marathon in 5 hours, and she's been told to drink at 1.2 liters per hour, 40 ounces per hour, but yet she's only sweating at 400 ml per hour, i.e. 18 fluid ounces per hour. There's a discrepancy, and she's actually gaining 600 ml every hour that she runs. Now, normally, you should just pass that as urine. But the trouble with this condition is, and what ultimately causes it, is not just over-drinking, but it's retaining the fluid. And to do that, you have to secrete a hormone called antidiuretic hormone. Now, normally, when we start running, we activate antidiuretic hormone, and that retains all the fluid because we never drink more than we need. When I say never, but most people don't. If you're over-drinking, you should be able to suppress antidiuretic hormones so you don't secrete it at all. And as a consequence, you just pass urine. So if you were drinking at 1.2 liters per hour but only needing 400 ml per hour, every hour you should be passing the difference. You should be passing 800 ml per hour. So what would happen was you'd be passing so much urine that you'd say, gee, I don't think I need to drink anymore. And you'd stop drinking. The problem in this condition is that you don't get that warning. So although you're drinking far too much, your body doesn't tell you that you're drinking too much because you retain it. The first thing that you'll notice is actually you become a bit sluggish, and you may notice that your intestine's making funny noises with all the fluid. You get this gurgling in the intestine because of there's so much fluid there. Then what happens, unfortunately, very late in the condition is you start to lose consciousness. You become very confused, and within a short time you would collapse unconscious and you may have an epileptic seizure. So those would be the characteristics: confusion, loss of consciousness, and epileptic seizure. And when you see that in a woman runner who's been running for 5 hours, you're almost certain that it's this condition. And what happens is once you've retained about 3 liters or 4 liters of extra fluid, the water moves into the cells, and it moves into the brain cells particularly. So the brain cells swell, and because they've swollen inside the skull, they obliterate or reduce the blood flow to the brain. And so certain parts of the brain start to get too little blood supply. And if it's to the control centers for breathing, you will then stop breathing, and as a consequence, ultimately you die as a consequence of not breathing. What happens next is if the doctor comes up or the ambulance attendant and sees you unconscious at the finish of the race or in the middle of the race, they say, gee, this person's dehydrated. I must give fluids. And so they whack in 2 liters of fluid, and that is a death sentence for that person. If you're already unconscious and you receive another 2 liters of fluid rapidly, your brain just swells, and it's very likely you'll stop breathing and die as a consequence. So that's the typical sequence of what happens.
So what you're really describing here is quite a tragic series of errors and judgment, really, that, you know, ranging from the publicization of best practices to what people are actually doing to how they get treated when they're actually in distress. So it seems like there's a whole chain of events here that happens that really contributes in a very multifaceted way to the problem. So it seems like to intervene in this would require education at a variety of levels. I mean, is that fair to say?
You're absolutely correct. And there were 12 deaths. In Waterlogged, I described 12 deaths from the condition and 1,600 people who were hospitalized with the condition. So that's an absolute minimum because that's what I could trace through the medical literature. And how many cases were not reported or misdiagnosed? So the deaths in runners, in marathon runners, were ascribed to a cerebral vascular accident instead of hyponatremia, for example. And in fact, the first case that occurred in the Valley of the Giants marathon in 1993 in a female runner was originally, it was thought that she'd had a cerebrovascular accident. And the diagnosis was missed for 7 hours, but then unfortunately she was brain dead by the time the diagnosis was made. So you're quite right. The education has to start with the athlete, and of at least 3 of the athletes who died, female athletes, had been specifically told that they must keep their urine white in the lead up to the marathon. And 2 of them had water bottles at work, and they were continuously drinking the fluids to make sure that they were going to the pass urine every hour or two. So that's where it starts. And they were told by their coaches to do that. And then, of course, the race organizers give out guidelines for drinking, and they say you must drink frequently and plenty and 1.2 liters and so on. And then the American College of Sports Medicine had its drinking guidelines that you must drink 1.2 liters per hour or as much as tolerable. And then the doctors, and they still believe this today, that dehydration is the premier cause of collapse in runners. And it's absolute nonsense that has never been shown. So, and then the ambulance drivers and the ambulance personnel also believe that dehydration is the cause of the problem. So all along the way, as you said, there are errors in information given to the runners and to the doctors and so on.
Okay, so let's say I'm a female athlete and I decide to adopt your stance on this. And so I'm running and I'm feeling dehydrated and I'm beginning to get concerned. I'm thinking, oh dear, now I'm dehydrated, now I'm sweating. I'm concerned that my body cannot handle this. How do you respond to the idea that we actually can't handle being dehydrated even a little bit?
I respond by saying that humans evolved as long-distance runners in the heat in Africa, and that we would not be human if our ancestors 2 million years ago had not been able to run without drinking for up to 3 or 4 hours chasing antelope and outrunning the antelope, so that they eventually got so hot that they had to stop. And we could only catch them if we could run beyond our thirst, so to speak. So that's the first point, that biologically humans are designed to run in the heat. That is why we sweat profusely. So the sweating is good, it's not bad. It's good because it allows you to maintain a low body temperature and therefore able to hunt your antelope and catch them and eat lots of protein and fat and get a big brain and so on and evolve into Homo sapiens. And then, so that's first point. Second point is that if you actually look at running races, the best runners are those who lose the most weight during the race and become the most dehydrated. We studied Haile Gebrselassie when he set the world record in the marathon. He lost 10% of his body weight. He lost just over 5 kilograms, despite drinking quite a lot. And he was running faster at the finish than at the start, so he was in good shape. We've looked at Ironman triathletes and we find that some of them lose 12% of their body weight and you cannot tell that they are so-called dehydrated, nor can they. They have minor thirst, which they then correct with time. So the industry very cleverly demonized dehydration and made it a condition which it is not. If you have symptoms during exercise, it's your brain speaking to you and trying to confuse you, and it's got nothing to do with dehydration at all. And unfortunately, what the industry managed to do was to say that your performance in the marathon is determined by one thing and one thing alone, whether or not you're dehydrated. And all of a sudden, the consequence of that was people thought they didn't have to train for the marathon. As long as you drink, you can finish the marathon. Whereas when I started running in the 1970s, late 60s, early 70s, we were told if you didn't finish a marathon, it was your fault because you didn't train hard enough. Now we're told if you don't finish a marathon, it's because there wasn't enough fluid available in the race. And that's what's happened.
You know, it's interesting that you comment on the fact that, in fact, people often do better when they're more dehydrated. And I'm also interested in the fact that a lot of this thinking for you has evolved in a geographic and cultural context where there is heat, and there is also a running culture in a sense. This is a place where people run, and there's like a long tradition of running. Can you comment briefly on perhaps the role of South African sports science in contributing to this debate in a very meaningful way?
I think you're absolutely right. It's absolutely contextual because, see, I was running the Comrades Marathon, and we used to drink very, very little, and so I had that experience, And again, I make the point that we ran 90 kilometers, that's 56 miles. And early on, the goal was to try to run the race without drinking. It was in the early 40s and 50s, you were a coward if you drank during the race. So that was the culture we came from. And the organizers, it was your responsibility to find your way to the finish. And they didn't provide fluids. You had to provide your own fluids. You had to find someone to drive along the course and then meet you every 10 kilometers and give you fluids. So that was the context in which we grew up. You had to learn to cope with the problem and solve it for yourself. The race organizers weren't going to solve it for you. And we knew that it was perfectly safe to run 56 miles drinking sparingly. Heat stroke wasn't an issue. We never had hyponatremia. And very few people needed to go to the medical tents at the finish. It was only after the 1980s when lots of fluid was available and there was a new generation of runners who were not properly trained that developed the problems. And my view remains that it's largely a problem of poor training and poor preparation. And then those athletes who trained poorly blamed the race organizers for not providing the fluids. So that was the context. And I think we also live in a completely different culture in South Africa, of course, that, you know, if I make an error, someone else isn't legally responsible. I'm kind of responsible. And I know the culture in the United States is different. You have to find someone to blame legally. And that's, we're brought up differently. And I think that has had a huge impact as well.
Yes, I think so, it's very, I mean, what you're really alluding to is a different concept of human capability.
Precisely, as well. I think in the developing world, you know, you've got to make it yourself. And we believe that, sorry, not that the Americans don't believe that. What I meant was, we believe that you're accountable and you have to go out there and do it and try hard, and you're not going to fail because the body fails. What Gatorade managed to do was to say that humans can't do these things. You have to have lots of sugar and carbohydrate and electrolytes, or else you can't do it. And that has never been the culture here. Here's the culture: you go out and do it on the minimum that you require. That the human body is a success, it's not a failure. And the medicalization of the last 20 or 30 years is that the human body is a failure. It can only survive if you give it pills and medicines and so on. In the developing world, we don't have that attitude. You know, we believe to some extent that the body's tough and you just got to tough it out and get to the finish and you can do it because generations of people have been doing it before you.
I think this is a really beautiful sentiment that the human body is a success, not a failure. And I think you've really put your finger on the central tension that exists in exercise currently. And it's interesting to see that we're observing a movement now back to this concept, you know, with an emerging interest in ancestral nutrition and primal fitness and this sort of thing. And who knows if it will actually go to a good place or whether it will be just, you know, become another kind of fad. But it really is interesting that you're drawing out these kinds of tensions in how we conceptualize the body and how we conceptualize human physiology, whether it's something that needs to be coddled and managed and technologically supported, or whether it's something that worked pretty darn good for 2 million years and that we really just need to, you know, help it along a little bit. So I think you've really definitely put your finger on this key tension. So let me just ask my final question, which is, you know, the book isn't out yet. It'll be out soon. How do you anticipate that it will be received? What kind of impact do you anticipate it will have?
Well, I think there are two levels. I think let's take the average runner. I hope that the average runner and the average athlete will read it and see that the evidence is absolutely compelling that there is no such medical condition as dehydration, and that provided you listen to your body, you'll be fine, and you don't need to take lots of carbohydrate or water or electrolytes during exercise. Your body will tell you, and provided you drink to thirst, you'll be fine. And what I've done is I've just put all the evidence out there, and it is absolutely compelling. And I must tell you, only about 60% of the evidence got in, because otherwise the book would have been too enormously long. But the editors felt that there was more than enough evidence to support the arguments. And incidentally, I wrote the book with a lot of anger, because I was very angry for many years that I'd been badly treated, in my view, by my colleagues. And I was writing with anger, but that has been taken out. And of course, now the book's published or about to be published, my anger's disappeared, because I wrote it into the book and it's on the pages of the book that never got published, but at least it's expressed. I think that it's going to be very embarrassing for a number of people who are considered leaders in this field. And it will be seen how they didn't look at all the information. So the reality in science is that if you look at 15% of the information, you can make a very strong case that you're not drinking enough during exercise and you've got to drink lots of sugar and got to take lots of electrolytes. And you can support that with, as I've said, 15% of the information. But when you look at 100% of the information, you see that that 15% is bogus and it's completely wrong. You have to see the totality. And my colleagues, sadly, they didn't look at the totality of the evidence, and then they, for whatever reason, they chose to ignore it. And I've also been able to track the actually origins of this overdrinking goes right back to United States Army and the scientists who work with them. And they are considered the leading exponents of what you should be drinking in the United States. So anyone who wants the advice goes to this grouping. And I show that their advice is completely unscientific and unsubstantiated. And it goes back to one man's opinion in 1982. And that influenced the field. And then the industry grabbed on that man's opinion and made it the gospel.
Well, it's certainly incredibly powerful when a scientist brings both emotion and evidence to something. I'm sure this book will be, you know, an incredible catharsis of knowledge for you, but also just a very powerful statement. I mean, when the two halves of the intellect are working in tandem, when there is that emotional basis plus, intuition and evidence and certainly a long history of understanding, I'm sure it will be quite an amazing testament to the power of experience and evidence. So is there anything that I haven't asked about that you think is important to mention?
No, thank you very much. I mean, I think you've had a fantastically insightful interview. So I really appreciate the questions you've asked, because it's the first time anyone has asked me those questions with such insight.
Oh, well, great. I'm so glad to hear it. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it very much. And hopefully your book will enjoy tremendous critical and commercial success.
Thank you, Krista. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks
and your
very
interest.
Much.
And again, thank you. It was a magnificent interview.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye.
So Dr. Tim Noakes' book, Waterlogged, The Serious Problem of Overhydration in Endurance Sports, outlines practices that endurance athletes should follow, variables they should consider, and guidelines they should use in maintaining proper fluid balance in sport training and performance. You can get it from Human Kinetics in May of 2012. Thanks for listening.